Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Good afternoon and Happy New Year. I'm pleased to welcome you to this Federal Society Courthouse Steps webinar featuring a preview of Monday's SCOTUS oral argument in Chevron v. Plaquemines Parish. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President for Practice Groups and Networks at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion on today's program belong to our speaker. We are delighted to have with us Christopher Mills, who is the founder of Spiro Law LLC. Christopher, happy Friday. How are you doing today?
Good, thanks. How are you?
Good, very well. And delighted to have you with us. We appreciate you making the time. We look forward to your insights in this important case. Before founding Spiro Law, Christopher was a partner at a national law firm and a constitutional law fellow at the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty. He clerked for Justice Clarence Thomas and Judge David Sentell of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. His JD is from Harvard and his undergrad is from Furman University. His full bio is available for our audience on our website, fedsoc.org. During the program, our audience can submit questions in the Q&A feature at the bottom of the screen, and we'll try to get to them towards the end of this session. With that table setting complete, let's jump into this very interesting case, which sits at the intersection of federalism, energy regulation, and environmental litigation strategy. Christopher, please kick us off by giving us the factual background of the case and tell us how the case arose.
Sure. So the litigation here began when several Louisiana coastal parishes filed lawsuits against a number of oil and gas companies alleging violations of a state law, the State and Local Coastal Resources Management Act of 1978. They alleged harm to their environment, coastline, erosion, marshlands from the oil companies drilling. The state law, as I said, was passed in 1978. It didn't take effect until 1980, and it had a grandfather clause that accepted any activities that were lawfully commenced before 1980. But the parishes sought damages for operations occurring decades before 1980, including during World War II, on the theory that those activities were not, quote unquote, lawfully commenced, and so didn't qualify to be grandfathered in. Specifically, the lawsuits alleged that the companies departed from standard industry practices by dredging canals instead of building roads, using vertical rather than directional drilling, using earthen pits instead of steel tanks for disposal, and extracting excessive amounts of oil. The oil companies, the respondents contended, the respondents here are the parishes, and they contended that these historical production practices cause significant environmental damage to Louisiana's coastal zone. So that's basically the lawsuit. It's a lawsuit under Louisiana state law for alleged damages occurring starting in in and before World War II.
Very good. Very helpful. And can you give us a little sense of what's happened in the lower courts up until now?
Yeah, so the case that gave rise to the Supreme Court case now was a fight about whether the oil companies could remove these cases to federal court. Some of the cases have gone forward. There was recently, in a related case, a judgment against one of the oil companies in one of the parishes for somewhere around $745 million. But this particular case involves whether the oil companies can remove to federal court. The district courts in both the Eastern and Western districts of Louisiana granted the parish's motion to remand to state court after the oil companies tried to remove. Basically, the statute here is the Federal Officer Removal Statute, which is found at 28 U.S.C. 1442A1. That language is important, so I'm going to read it, even though normally statutory language makes everyone gloss over a little bit. So it says a civil action. It says in relevant part, a civil action that is commenced in a state court and that is against or directed to any of the following may be removed to the federal district court. And that includes the United States or any agency thereof or any officer or any person acting under that officer of the United States or of any agency for or relating to any act under color of such office. So the critical language there is any person under acting under an officer of the United States for or relating to any act under color of such office. So the components there, obviously, we're talking about oil companies, so they aren't direct agencies of the United States. The two questions were whether they were acting under an officer of the United States, particularly when they were making oil in the context of refining oil in the context of World War II, and then whether that those actions were for or relating to a federal act. So the district court said no, while the companies may have acted under federal officers regarding their wartime refining operations, they failed to show that they were acting under federal direction for the oil production activities actually challenged in the lawsuit. So in other words, even if they had to refine oil to fulfill their World War II contracts with the government, those contracts didn't really cover how they needed to get the oil out of the ground. And that's what these state lawsuits were about. So the district courts concluded there was not a sufficient connection or association between the federal refining contracts and the field production activities. The Fifth Circuit affirmed the remand orders in a 2-1 decision. So there was two holdings here. First, on the acting under question, the panel unanimously held that the companies did satisfy the acting under requirement because they had wartime contracts to supply the federal government with high octane aviation gasoline. Where the Fifth Circuit diverged was on the relating to question. A two-judge majority held that the suits were not removable because the challenged production activities did not relate to the federal refining contracts. The majority said the contracts lacked any explicit, quote, directive pertaining to the oil production activities and gave the companies complete latitude to purchase crude on the open market rather than producing it themselves. So the majority basically said the analysis needed to be limited to the express language of the refining contracts. Judge Oldham dissented. He argued that the production of crude oil is undeniably related to the refining of the gasoline because crude oil is the primary and indispensable component of the fuel. He said the majority's requirement for a specific contractual directive basically reinstated a causal test that Congress had eliminated in a 2011 amendment to the statute, which added the or relating to language. And Judge Oldham said that without the challenged production efforts, it was unclear how the companies could have met the wartime quantities of gasoline that the federal government was demanding.
And if I'm understanding Judge Oldham, he was saying that basically the amendment in 2011 by Congress in effect broadened the scope or the universe of cases that would fall under the statute.
Right. And the 2011 amendment is important here. It added that or relating to language, which basically, obviously the parties disagree as to how much that expanded the statute, but sure. It certainly expanded it somewhat from, it was instead of just being an act under color of a federal office, it was an act under or relating to under the office's requirements. So the oil companies moved for rehearing en banc, which the Fifth Circuit narrowly denied in a 7-6 vote.
Very good. Okay. Well, that's most helpful in orienting us all and getting us up to speed on a procedural background. And that brings us to the court itself. And I thought at the outset, we might talk a little bit about the court's grant of certiorari in this instance. And I think there's a dispute amongst the parties about what the actual scope of the grant is.
Yeah, so the two questions the petitioners, the oil companies, presented and the Supreme Court granted were number one, whether a causal nexus or contractual direction test survives the 2011 amendment to the Federal Officer Removal Statute, which again adds that or relating to language. And then number two, whether a federal contractor can remove to federal court when sued for oil production activities undertaken to fulfill a federal oil refinement contract. And we'll get to sort of the parties' disagreements about, whether we should be focusing on the acting under or the related to prongs of the removal statute.
Good. Okay. Well, that's most helpful. Do you want to just dive into the various merit arguments of the parties?
Sure, that makes sense. So the arguments obviously center on kind of those two phrases, how a private company proves it was acting under a federal officer and how the challenged conduct must relate to the federal authority. Again, the Fifth Circuit unanimously agreed that the oil companies were acting under a federal officer. The dispute was whether the conduct related to the federal authority. So the petitioners argue that the Fifth Circuit improperly narrowed a statute that Congress has repeatedly expanded to protect federal operations. So the federal removal statute has a history going back some 200 years or so. It's kind of consistently been broadened from an initial pretty narrow focus on things like customs officers to all federal officers to some private companies acting under a federal office. And then in 2011, the addition of the related to language broadened it further. So the petitioners focused on that 2011 amendment, saying that it replaced the old strict causal nexus test with a much broader connection or association standard. They point to other Supreme Court statutory interpretation cases that interpret related to quite broadly. And so using that, they argue that there doesn't need to be a specific federal directive for every challenged act. So applying that here, the federal government in World War II didn't have to say, here is how you have to get the oil, as long as it was kind of implied in the contract that you need to get the oil so that you can refine it for us to use for the aviation gasoline. On that point, they kind of make an argument about wartime integration. They argue that there's a indisputable connection between the production of crude oil and the fulfillment of the federal refinement contracts. They point out that they were vertically integrated companies, and so the extraction of raw materials was necessary to deliver the finished product. They have a couple specific terms in those contracts that they emphasize, price escalation clause tied to crude oil costs, federal tax exemption for crude production as evidence that the government itself recognized that link between production of extraction of the crude oil and refinement. And then they argue also that the Petroleum Administration for War, PAW, supervised the entire industry, making their production activities part of a federally directed mission. In terms of the consequences, they say that exposing federal contractors to local prejudice in state courts for actions taken during a national emergency will deter private sector cooperation in future crises. A number of the amicus briefs, including one that I filed on behalf of a group of U.S. senators, Mike Lee, Ted Cruz, and others, kind of highlighted these potential chilling effects. We looked at some of the ongoing state hostility toward certain private contractors working for the federal government, including, for instance, ICE, which has obviously been in the news lately, and explained that, it's not clear that contractors in those types of fields would be able to get a fair shake in state courts, which is kind of why this federal removal statute works and why it exists in the first place, is to remove the danger of unfair local or state prejudice by letting people, letting federal officers or those acting under their direction remove to federal court. And I would just emphasize, you know, for those who may be new here, the question is here is not on the merits, you know, whether the oil companies are liable or not. The question is just, who hears the case? Is this case going to be heard in federal court, or is it going to be heard in state court? But the theory of the federal removal statute is that that question matters because the state courts may have local prejudices by judges or juries that make it difficult to get an even-handed adjudication. So that's kind of the petitioner's arguments. The respondents' arguments, the respondents are the local parishes as well as the state of Louisiana. They argue that the petitioners are trying to mix and match federal authority from one activity, refining, to shield unrelated conduct, the oil extraction and production. They also emphasize the two different questions under the statute, which they identify as the who question. The defendant has to be acting under a federal officer, and the what question, which is the suit relating to the federal acts. And they argue that the petitioners failed the who question because they were not cloaked in federal authority when they performed the specific oil productions challenged in the lawsuit. And we'll talk about this more in a minute, but it kind of goes to, in some ways, the parties are trying to argue two slightly different things. The respondents are kind of focused on who, were they really acting under a federal officer, and the petitioners are focusing on the relating to the what question. Let's see, the respondents argue that the PAW, the federal agency program, severed the link between the production and the refining. They present evidence that the government directed crude to refineries based on national need, regardless of which company produced it, meaning that the petitioners often refined crude that they didn't produce and produced crude they didn't refine. So basically they say these things were just separate. They also say that the World War the United States filed an amicus brief here supporting petitioners, arguing that the wartime context was unique. The United States argued that the Fifth Circuit erred by requiring a specific contractual directive for production of oil. It says that some relation between production and refining should suffice. The United States also says that petitioners were acting under federal authority for the production itself. So this goes back to the who question. During World War II, the government and the oil industry formed what the United States here calls an unprecedented and effective partnership, where the PAW, the federal agency, supervised every aspect of production, including specific practices like well spacing that the parishes are challenging in this lawsuit. To go back to the who or the what question, so the petitioners say that the focus, the respondents focus on who, the acting under prong, kind of deviates from the question presented. They point out that the Fifth Circuit said that the petitioners did satisfy the acting under prong. They argue that this point was kind of conceded at the Fifth Circuit, and that the acting and that the petition. That the state's theory kind of conflates the who and the what question. The who question is just supposed to determine if the defendant has the necessary relationship with the federal government, while the relating to prong defines which suits can be removed. So there's some question there about how to decide what acting under means and whether that question is even really properly before the court here.
Good. Very good. Okay. And depending on how the court sorts all this out, what are the implications you see, the consequences, following the court's ruling in this case, analysis and ruling?
Yeah, so
they could be very narrow or quite broad and have an impact for a lot of different entities and contractors.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, the obvious implications would be for the oil companies here. As I said, there was a parallel coastal case involving a recent $744 million state court verdict. So, you know, the verdicts like that obviously have an effect on energy production and costs and decisions going forward, even though liability here would be stretching back to World War II activities. Another, I guess, pressing concern that the petitioners present in their amici, including the brief I filed, argue is that it could make private contractors more hesitant to help the federal government out if anything outside of the express contractual terms of their agreement with the federal contract could mean that they're stuck in state courts that may be hostile to the things they were doing on the federal government's behalf. So there's a concern that the federal government, which especially relies on contractors in many areas, again, we see this in ICE, but we see this in lots of other federal fields, the government contractors may be less hesitant to pitch in and help when the federal government asks them to. And then obviously there's, no one knows what the next emergency would be. That's kind of what gave rise here is, the oil companies have an argument that, hey, we were asked to sort of help defend the country in this extraordinary situation in World War II. And now we're going to be put on the hook for liability for, millions, billions of dollars, and not even be able to defend ourselves in what we consider to be a neutral federal forum. I would say those are the types of implications. Obviously, Louisiana, argues that there are contrary considerations here. They argue that the environmental damage suffered by allegedly suffered by their parishes requires compensation, and that the oil companies had other ways to fulfill these requirements, the federal requirements, while also not contributing to that environmental damage. So that's kind of the big picture questions here.
Yeah, that's very good and very helpful. Just a note to our audience, as I mentioned at the outset, if you'd like to ask a question in our audience Q&A, you can throw the question in the Q&A function at the bottom of your screen. We'll queue people up and get to them towards the end. So I guess, Christopher, looking ahead at Monday, from your perspective, what would you suggest that, practitioners particularly should be listening to in oral argument? And what sort of questions are you looking to hear from the court?
Yeah, so I think one big question would be whether the state gets any traction in trying to shift focus a little bit to the who question. I would say it's become an increasing feature of Supreme Court arguments to have this sort of many battles over the question presented. And I would say that it's especially common in litigation from states where you have states kind of, and I'm not necessarily accusing Louisiana of doing this here, but of shifting from maybe one position in the lower courts to a slightly different position when it realizes, oh, we've actually got to defend this thing at the Supreme Court. And so I think if there's any, if justices are focusing on the, were they really acting under a federal officer and how do we decide that? I think that's would be what the state wants to talk about. I would look out for questions on are the justices focused on the what question, which is kind of the question presented number one, or are they focused on the who question, the acting under, which is what the state seems to want to talk about. So that's one question. And then I think the other thing to look out for is just how the justices try and figure out what test should apply to relating to, because obviously that can be a phrase that can be quite broad. I mean, you see it all the time in subpoenas or discovery materials or some statutes, and it can mean almost anything, or it can mean very little. So I think you'll see, I would expect to see the justices maybe giving some hypotheticals about, well, does this relate to, and try to figure out how to articulate a line. Again, you've seen that in a number of recent cases where they kind of throw out, well, what if we said this was the line? You know, would each party be satisfied with that? So I think you could see some of that here. I think if the justices are emphasizing the wartime aspect, then that's probably going to be beneficial for the petitioners, because courts tend to defer to the federal government's explanation of what it needs to do during war times. And obviously World War II kind of qualifies as a paradigmatic example of where there was extensive federal government needs from the private sector in World War II. So I would look for that. And then I believe yesterday the court announced that Justice Alito was recusing himself. So there will be 8 justices, which could have an effect when an 8 justice court splits evenly. The judgment below is affirmed without a decision typically. So if there's a disagreement, say, about how broadly relating to goes and whether that helps, whether that's enough for the petitioners to get into relating to in this case, and the court went 4-4, and then the Fifth Circuit's decision would be affirmed. I do think it's just worth noting, because Supreme Court recusal has been kind of a question lately, that the court provided a pretty thorough explanation of why Justice Alito recused. It explained that he owned some sort of stock interest in one of the oil companies that had withdrawn its participation in the Supreme Court proceedings, but was still a defendant in the original proceedings below. So, you know, the court sort of articulated why it appears that Justice Alito participated at this point, but was not going to participate in the argument or the decision, in a relatively thorough explanation, which is not required. So anyway, not to sidetrack us onto recusal issues, but it's worth noting, particularly because it could affect how the court decides this one.
Very good. We have our first question from the audience. Robert Fitzpatrick asks, and he points to Fed. He says Fed's contract for a building to be used for a certain purpose and separately contracts with a different company to hire the people who work in the building to fulfill the purpose. Related, he asks, goes to federal on a negligent hiring claim? ? You trump that. Sorry, laying the question.
Yeah. So I think if the contractor is hiring people to basically do federal duties, then I think that makes more sense as we are acting under a federal agreement, and that agreement is related to the office. So I think if I'm understanding right, you know, I think the federal government hiring people through a contractor and sort of telling them what to do probably qualifies. But again, it would kind of depend on whether the suit was relating to. And so, again, this is the what question, was relating to the federal duties they were supposed to do. And that might depend on exactly what the kind of negligent hiring allegations were. Here you have that because, you know, they were refining gasoline for the government. And so the question is just, does the extraction relate to the refinement? So I think you'd have a similar question there. Like, what is the connection between the actual claim and the federal act?
Good. Very good. The next question is sort of where I was leading. I was asking you about, you know, what are you looking for in terms of questions and subject matter from the bench on Monday. This question is, you know, is there, do you expect potentially questions out of the ordinary, any tips or tells where the decision might be going? And then he also asks, additionally, do you expect questions on World War II time contracts and whether or not they do not apply? And then he reiterates, I guess he's looking for your prognostication about where the decision might go at the end.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you hear justices asking really specific questions about the World War II contracts, you know, well, it doesn't say extract or produce, you know, that's some indication that they are skeptical of reading the removal statute more broadly. I think if you have justices kind of operating off of the intuition that, well, of course you got to get the oil if you're going to refine it, then, you know, obviously that kind of favors the petitioner's theory. And then otherwise, just what I said before, whether they're focusing on the who question or the what question, which each of the parties kind of wants to focus on one or the other, and then whether they are using the same broad interpretation of relating to that they tend to use in at least some other context, or whether they're suggesting that the 2011 amendment could be read more narrowly. And then that's the last thing I'd point out. If justices are emphasizing the historical progression of the statute, that's definitely favoring the petitioners, I would say, because the whole history has been one of from very narrow applications, not even to all federal officers 200 plus years ago to today, where we've extended it undoubtedly to private entities working on the government's behalf. And the question is just how broadly it goes.
Very good. The next question from audience: suppose a plaintiff is suing for injuries based on the impact of a company's business practice, and the federal government has hired the company to do to those same things, but the plaintiff's injury does not actually arise from the work the company does for the government. Is it still related?
You know, that's the type of hypothetical that I would think the court would, you know, a justice could plausibly be asking. I would say it would be hard to see how it would be sufficiently related to. I think that would be a harder one, just because if, you know, on day one, I do work for the government, and on day two, I'm doing work for somebody else. That's a little different than it's kind of the vertically integrated issue you have here in the oil companies, where they needed the crude oil to refine it. So I think there you kind of have more of a vertical step and a little stronger argument on related to than you would where it's just I do similar work for two entities.
Good, very good. Okay, well, I guess I think we've run through the Q&A from our audience. Do you have, since you've indicated that Justice Alito's recused and we're dealing with eight possible votes, do you have, and we've got you on the record and recording this for posterity, would you like to take a guess at how you see this thing coming out?
Sure. I mean,
and you can pass if not. I'm just asking as a final question.
Yeah. So I don't have a great prediction on this one. I would just say that I would feel pretty good if I were the oil companies. I mean, the court first decided to grant the case, which is usually a good indication for the petitioners, other things being equal. You know, they six judges, conservative leaning judges on the Fifth Circuit kind of agreed with the petitioners, which I would say generally is also a good sign for, at the mm-hmm. Supreme Court. So, you know, I would think the petitioners would feel good about counting to five, but I'm not sure how much further they might get, especially with Justice Alito recused.
Okay, very good. Any final thoughts you want to leave for our audience? We, again, do appreciate your time and insights.
I think that's it.
Okay, good. Well, again, thank you very much. It's been an excellent preview. We're looking forward to getting started on Monday with the court. We want to welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.